From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, Politics, Prayers, and Passion. The Terri Schiavo drama, in all its complexity, goes on, and with it, the nation's charged debate over life and death. Issues that once lived in Sunday sermons now rule kitchen tables and workplace water coolers. Terri Schiavo's case isn't the only life and death issue that has people up in arms. There's the war in Iraq, the debate over the death penalty, the core fight over abortion. There's Darfur death and poverty death and stem cell life. The list goes on and on. Tonight on Point, clashing American attitudes over life, death, choice, and the culture of life. We begin tonight in Washington with a look at where public opinion on the tortured Schiavo case stands. When Congress voted overwhelmingly early Monday to allow Schiavo's parents to take their case to federal court, they did not act on majority public opinion, according to the polls. A series of surveys has taken the pulse of the American public on the issue. Andrew Kohut is director of the Pew Research Center. I asked him to describe the direction of public thinking on the Schiavo case now.
Well, the gist of public thinking is that the Congress should not have gotten involved. And there have been three polls, one by Fox News, one by ABC, and one by Gallup. And they all three show majority support for the husband's decision to remove the feeding tubes. And this comes at a time when the public's paying a great deal of attention to this story. This is an important story to many people. The ABC survey found that one-third of their respondents, that they knew of a friend, or they had a friend or relative whose life support had been turned off. And they had over half that number had participated in that decision. So this is not an issue that's twice removed from the ordinary citizen.
So strong majorities in favor of Michael Schiavo's position, that is removing the feeding tube, letting Terri Schiavo die. And yet we've heard on this show and elsewhere this week, Andy, people saying it doesn't really matter because the core constituency that's so focused on keeping this life going is so politically potent that it speaks louder than whatever the polls may show about a general majority.
Well, the Christian conservatives, I think, have been successful in making the case that the election, the last presidential election, was decided by moral values. They have a lot of political capital, I think, and much of it well-earned, but a bit of it overstated. And there are limits to their power. You know, the National Rifle Association has been able to convey to political leaders that even though most people don't agree with their positions against strong positions against gun control, their members have such intense opinions that politically it's a risky thing to do. And I think that the Christian conservatives are trying to make that case with their constituency as well.
When you look at the numbers, do they have a good chance of doing that? Are we going to see national policies on life and death determined by a very focused minority in the way that national policies on gun ownership have been determined for many years by the NRA?
Well, that's an open question. I think it's going to be determined by what happens in coming elections. The power of the Christian conservatives is emerging. Many political analysts think that the moral values factor was overstated in the election. I happen to be one of them. I'm not saying that Christian conservatives are not an important constituency, but too much has been made of this. But I think in this particular case, when you come to the question of end-of-life issues, there are some other factors that might give pause to the power of social conservatives in this regard. One is that we have an aging population that wants to control its own decisions about life and death. There's great skittishness about extended life support. And clearly these polls, in the case of Ms. Schiavo, have shown that the public is not sympathetic to extending life when doctors say that there's no chance.
Andy, you've written that these strongly held moral or ideological positions run up against a very deep and old tradition of American pragmatism. Do you see that pragmatic attitude extending now even to issues of life and death?
I think more so with life and death and issues that are close to people's lives than foreign policy and things that people only read about and experience secondhand. I mean, we've seen it in the trend on stem cell research with growing percentages saying they're more inclined to support stem cell research that might lead to new cures, even though they realize it means ending potential life of human embryos. People, you know, want science to work for their health care and in the future. They understand that questions of life and extensions of life and science are very complicated ones, and they're going to make pragmatic, practical decisions, I think, not ideological ones, even though this is a very religious country, in fact, a conservative country in many respects. And the ABC poll found most conservatives that it polled this weekend saying that they supported the decision to remove Ms. Schiavo's feeding tubes.
We have learned that language and the way issues are framed is very important politically. The banner that the right is working under here is the culture of life. As a pollster, as an analyst, Andy, what do you think of that framing? Is that a strong one? What does that suggest to most Americans? Does it mean that if you want to go along with Michael Schiavo, that you're supporting a culture of death?
Well, people have complicated views about life. On the one hand, they can be against capital punishment for abortion or vice versa or some combination of that. People don't have only one view about life, and it's a complicated issue, and I think people judge situations on their own merit. People have a very divided view about abortion, for example. They support the general Roe v. Wade decision and the general right of women to choose, but they don't like to see abortion. They think abortion is abused, and they think there are too many abortions, and they support many abortion reforms. And so you can't really say that there's one easy, quick answer about the way people feel about the culture of life with respect to abortion. And certainly the views that people have about abortion are different than the views that they have about capital punishment or now these end-of-life issues. So it may make a good media line, but it doesn't explain a lot when it comes to how people feel, think about things.
And as you write, at the end, it comes down to very personal circumstances of individuals and families who have to grapple with these things. Well, for this week, I guess, an intensely focused minority steering the U.S. Congress, despite that majority that would feel the other way. Andy Cohut, thanks for your insights.
You're quite welcome, Tom.
Andrew Cohut is director of the Pew Research Center. He spoke with me from Washington. We are talking tonight about America's culture war over life, death, and the rallying cry of a culture of life. Andy Cohut just laid out public opinion on the Schiavo case. Now we're going to dig deeper and wider. We want to understand what's fueling this passionate divide. To help us, we'll turn tonight to two moral thinkers, one a Catholic priest and the other a Methodist minister with very different takes. You can join the conversation. Are we all moralists now? And what's the driving fear and motivation of the culture of life disciples? What are the fears and motivations of the choice crowd? What is this fight really about? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Richard John Newhouse, by all accounts one of the country's leading thinkers on the role of religion in contemporary life. He's a Catholic priest, president of the Institute on Religion and Public Life, and editor-in-chief of the publication First Things. Richard John Newhouse, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Good to be with you, Tom.
And with us from Dallas, Texas, is William Lawrence, dean of the Perkins School of Theology at Southern Methodist University. He is a Methodist minister, has held leadership positions in the United Methodist Church, and is a driving force at SMU and beyond. William Lawrence, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
You're quite welcome.
So we're going to wade into some deep waters here tonight, and I guess maybe the place to start is just with the case at hand to hear where each of you stand. We've just got a couple minutes before the break, but Richard John Newhouse, I'll turn to you first. On Terri Schiavo, where do you stand?
Well, Terri Schiavo is not dying, and
well, she is at the moment, is she not? I mean, she's
well, she is at the moment, as we would all be dying if we were denied
without the life support,
food and hydration. Mm-hmm. But when her feeding tubes and hydration tubes were pulled, she was not dying. What in fact is happening is that she is being made to be dead, if one prefers that to the simpler locution that she is being killed, because in the judgment of some within her family, namely her husband Michael, she is living a life that is not worth living. And this is the logic that we are being forced to confront here. It's an astonishing thing that, of course, it has come to a head around this one case when, as you have already indicated in your conversation with Andy Cohen,
yeah.
That these circumstances are not infrequent. But it's well to remember that all the things we might discuss here about the division of powers, the politics of the thing, the role between the judiciary and the legislature, et cetera, all these questions finally come down to the question of what is a form of killing. It is the taking of an innocent human life with direct intent to do that. And it is this that, as a society, we have to think long and hard about doing. Only one state, there have been many referendums, and this touches on the earlier conversation about polling data and majority and minority opinion. There have been referendums on the death with dignity or right to die question, and the only place in the United States where that referendum, where that vote is carried, is in Oregon.
And yet we've got this split. Now, Richard John Newhouse, William Lawrence, please stand by. Mr. Lawrence will be right back to get your view here. We're talking tonight about the culture war over life, death, and the rallying cry of a culture of life. You can join us. Do you identify with the people praying on their knees outside Terry Schiavo's hospice, or are you baffled by them? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about clashing American attitudes over life, death, choice, and the culture of life. You can join the conversation tonight. Why have these issues of life itself become a central battleground for American politics, for an American culture clash here? And what is the drama being played out in all this? The fears, the hopes, the clash of worldviews. How do you understand what's going on? We're at 1-800-423-8255 tonight. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Lucky to be joined tonight from New York by Richard John Newhouse, founder of the Institute for Religion and Public Life, editor-in-chief of the journal First Things, and from Dallas, Texas by William Lawrence. He's been a Methodist minister for more than three decades in local and national church leadership. He's dean of the Perkins School of Theology at Southern Methodist University. From 1998 to 2001, he served as senior minister at Washington, D.C.'s Metropolitan Methodist Church, the National Church of United Methodism. William Lawrence, there's a lot we want to hear from you tonight, but I guess I'd ask you to weigh in first. The same point that Richard John Newhouse has on the Terry Schiavo case, he describes it as boiling down to a denial of life. How do you see it?
For me, I cannot help but reflect on the many pastoral situations that not only I, but anyone in ministry and local churches and diocesan and annual conference and presbyterial settings has had to face. When one goes through end-of-life pastoral care situations in the complexities of families, the complexities of medical care, these are profoundly difficult issues through which many families have had to struggle. For Christians, the struggle is not only with the circumstances that occur at the end of life. What is the appropriate level of care? What's the appropriate level of life support? When should systems, mechanical systems, be used to sustain, prolong life beyond some appropriate stage? All those difficult decisions that families and doctors and pastoral caregivers have to ponder, all of them for Christians occur within the context of the faith that Christians hold, that life is a gift in the form in which we experience it while we are here on earth, but that the gift of life does not end when life on this earth ends. And for us, therefore, particularly in this Holy Week and as we approach the celebration of Easter Sunday, we're confronted with the hope that we have that is made known through the resurrection as well.
So you're looking to eternal life, but the the question, of course, that has everyone riven here is the life right in front of us. How do you interpret the fervor with which the people, you know, we've seen the pictures on TV, people on their knees outside the hospice in Florida, their faces just clenched in passionate prayer. What do you, I'll ask Richard John Newhouse, but what do you think is going on there? Is that somehow, is there such a thing as too much clinging to life from in a religious perspective, William Lawrence?
There's certainly such a thing as seeking to prolong life in certain circumstances just because the mechanical means to do so are available. And that's one of the profound decisions that has been faced. But even though the national attention may have been riveted on this Schiavo family dilemma within recent weeks, perhaps months, the truth is that this family has been living with the complexities of this situation for 15 years. And regarding those who are engaged in physical demonstrations of prayer and clenched faces, as you've described them, those scenes are repeated thousands and thousands of times in hospital emergency rooms and intensive care units and bedsides and battlefields all over the place. What is going on, I think, might best be described as the shared grief that all of us experience when we confront this perimeter of life at the point of death, and to confront the mystery of it all. And I fully respect the people who are engaged in those forms of prayer on the street corners and sidewalks, but I think they have to be seen in the context of all the other many settings where a similar grieving process is occurring.
Richard John Newhouse, how about it? Is there a time to let go for Christians to look to eternal life? William Lawrence talking about this perimeter of life that modern technology has turned into a kind of movable line.
Yeah, no, I think what Dr. Lawrence says on a number of scores is very important to emphasize. And it is true, of course, that Christians have not simply at the end of life, but one hopes throughout our lives, our eyes on eternal life. Our eternal destiny will depend to some degree on how we treated those whom God placed within our custody and within our care. We are not facing in this case some extraordinary circumstance of mechanical or technological advance that is prolonging a death. The many circumstances that Dr. Lawrence correctly refers to and that I've had, as any priest or minister has had long years of experience with, are indeed anguishing circumstances in which the question is whether you are simply prolonging death. And then the question of using extraordinary means, which often are counterproductive, which often are unnecessary. You asked at the beginning of the session, Tom, whether we are all becoming moralists now. And the answer is yes, we must all be moralists in the sense that what we're facing here is not, first of all, a political question or a medical technological question. We're facing a moral question. And that is it ever permissible to intend to take a person's life, a person who is not dying, unless we withdraw food and water? Food and water is not a new invention. It's not a modern technological innovation. Food and water is the most basic gift that we owe to those who are dependent upon us.
And yet in the public opinion polls, you've seen them as well, I'm sure, Americans are saying Michael Schiavo is on the right side of this question.
I think you make a good point, and Andy Kohut, who you interviewed, made a good point. And again, let me refer to the fact that there have been, over the last 15 years, a lot of referendums and discussions of this and a number of votes in different states. And at the beginning of the discussion of right to die and death with dignity, the support is overwhelmingly in favor of the Oregon-type assisted, doctor-assisted suicide approach. But as people think about it more, it's perfectly understandable that people, especially older people, who are conscious of their being in the twilight years, realize that they may be in a circumstance where they don't want to be. But we know, and we know this from pastoral experience as well, and I think almost any doctor who attends the dying knows this, that when people actually find themselves in a difficult circumstance, which, when they were healthy, they would say, oh, if I'm ever in that circumstance, I'd rather be dead. But when they actually get there, it is not so clear at all. In fact, it is typically the case that they want to live.
But let me ask you, if I may, Richard John Newhouse, when you see the fervor, nearly what I describe as desperation of people, let's say, praying outside this hospice in Florida, mm-hmm. people who do not personally know Terri Schiavo at all. She's a person. She's alive. She's also a symbol to them. What is driving the desperation? Do you see in those opinion polls an erosion of commitment to life? Is that what the culture of life language is meant to intend to expose?
Well, I think, you know, throughout human history, I mean, it's always important, I think, to put this into perspective. We're much given to the pressures of immediacy and presentism here.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout human history, there's the contest between what might be called the culture of life and the culture of death. That way of framing it, of course, has entered into our current discussion primarily through the witness of the Holy Father, of John Paul II. Mm-hmm. But
no, President Bush has taken that language up without hesitation.
He has definitely picked up on this language. I think it is useful language. I mean, obviously, it speaks to a disposition. And the disposition is against any notion, and especially disabled people. And there are thousands of people in the United States who are as disabled as is Ms. Schiavo, Terri Schiavo. But people who are disabled and capable of expressing themselves, they see in this themselves in that situation. They see a society, or at least a good portion of the society, backed by a judiciary in this case, saying that you have a life that's not worth living, and therefore we are going to make you dead. And the shivers that go down the spine of any thoughtful person, we've been through this. The 20th century is the bloodiest century in human history, the century we've just been through, far and away. There's not any competition. And we know what happens, whether it be under ideological Marxist-Leninist or Maoist or Nazi forms, what happens when human beings are put into a category called a life not worth living, and that other people are going to decide that, therefore, since that life is not worth living, it is going to terminate it. We are going to terminate it, and we're going to terminate it by withdrawing the most elementary duty of food and water. She's not on a respirator. There's no high-tech medicine involved here whatsoever.
We all know the story. William Lawrence at SMU, I'm not looking to set up a Catholic Methodist imbroglio here, but just to jump off, the Vatican has been very outspoken on this, as you know, and today the Vatican newspaper criticized the U.S. District Judge James Whittemore, who refused to order the reinsertion of the feeding tube, and again criticized what the Vatican newspaper called a society incapable of appreciating and defending the gift of life. This gets back to the Pope's culture of life framing of this. Do you see a battle between a culture of life and a culture of death? What do you think of the way that the Schiavo supporters, let's say, are framing that debate, that conversation?
Well, the language culture of life versus culture of death is, for a lot of people, a helpful, if perhaps overly dramatic, way of framing the discussion. And I certainly welcome the Vatican's published contributions to the discussion. The difficulty is that in a very controversial, pastoral, and painfully difficult situation, such as the one the Schiavo family has been facing for these 15 years, the reality comes down to the kind of thing Father Newhouse has just been discussing, where it's a clear moral issue, but the problem is who gets to make the decision regarding the moral issue. In this contest between life and life, let me cite, for example, some of the language that the United Methodist Church has in the past used with regard to the question of abortion. And some of the phrasing has included language like the following: the struggle of life with life. There are situations where it's not culture of life versus culture of death so much as culture of life versus culture of life. And somebody has to make a very complex, profoundly difficult moral choice. In the case of the Schiavo family, and in the cases of thousands of families who may be facing somewhat similar circumstances, the moral decision has to be allowed to lodge with those who are closest to the matter and most aware of the drama and the difficulty of drawing out the conclusions of the decision has to be made. In this case, as I think in most of the pastoral cases with which I'm familiar, the real difficulty is to allow those persons closest to know all the circumstances of the choice to be the ones who make that decision.
William Lawrence, do you fear that the United States as a culture is drifting away from a culture of life? There's the framing, there's the suggestion, and there, I guess, is the source of the passion behind these battle lines. But do you think that's accurate or not?
Well, certainly, if you can move out of the discussion, particularly of the Schiavo case, to some other arenas, I think we have to, as Americans, acknowledge the reality of the places where we typically look for our entertainment. Look into such arenas, for instance, as the language of violence that emerges in many action films, the language of violence that emerges in a lot of video games that are exceedingly popular and about which parents worry, where violence, or if you want to use the phrase, the culture of death, has been reduced to a casual entertainment medium. The problem with that is that life and death issues become mere caricatures. They lose their human component and human potential. I think that was particularly illustrated in the difficulties surrounding some of the material in the film Fahrenheit 9/11, where there were objections by some people to showing particularly gruesome scenes that were actually documentary footage of true human beings injured in war. And yet, in fictionalized creations, in films and video games, we see far more gruesome acts of violence that are used strictly for entertainment.
But it's not just media, of course. I mean, there's death in war, there's death in regions of starvation and AIDS, there's the death penalty. Is there a selective application, in your view, William Lawrence, of the culture of life framing?
Is there a selective application of that? I think it's, I would probably use the word eclectic. That is, it is randomly available. And we live in a free society where people are free to choose forms of entertainment that are expressed in a lot of different ways. But we are also having to confront the realities of life and death in that whole array of issues that you've just outlined. And again, the question really becomes, in a matter of moral choice, who gets to decide in any of these individual cases? Who gets to decide whether to enter into a military conflict? Who gets to decide in the conflict of life with life whether it is more noble to serve in a military situation or more noble to withhold one's service in a military situation?
Let me begin to turn to our callers. A lot have been waiting to come in. Catherine's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Catherine. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Well,
thanks for taking my call. I have just a couple of observations to make, and I have to just tell you I'm very stirred by the whole conversation. I'm very interested in the kinds of language that our guests are using. I'd also like to tell you a little bit about myself. I grew up in a religious community. Hmm. I helped my father die a number of years ago.
As in assisted suicide or something else?
It was at his wish that I withheld his insulin from him. He mm-hmm. said, please don't give it to me.
Our time is short before the break. Take us on in your story, Catherine.
Yes. And my brother-in-law was murdered a few years ago, and his killer's on death row, and we have refused to come forward to say that we would like to see the death penalty enforced for him. And I had an abortion a number of years ago.
So you've had to think a lot about life and death.
I've had to think about all of these issues, and I would like to say that I'm unhappy to hear this language of polarization that takes us away from the deeply personal, heartfelt choices that all of us have to face eventually in our lives.
But as you made all those choices and confronted those realities, do you feel that you're living in a culture that favors life, a culture that favors or is too easy toward death?
I don't like the way that this whole discussion is being framed because I don't see it polarized in that way. I think every choice, as my own choices were framed, are very, very personal, very, very heartfelt, very thoughtful. It's not a quick, easy, rapid decision for convenience's sake.
So let's not draw it down to that kind of easy phrasing. Catherine, thank you very much for your call. Richard John Newhouse, William Lawrence, please stand by. We're talking tonight about the culture war over life, death, and the rallying cry of a culture of life. Who do you want to hear from on life and death? Your clergy, your congressman, your conscience? And what's the deeper debate or clash of worldviews playing out behind the life and death dramas? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about clashing American attitudes over life, death, choice, and the culture of life. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think is the driving fear or motivation of the culture of life disciples? And whether at the womb or at the end of life, what's the driving motivation of the choice crowd? Is anyone consistent in their stand on life and death between the Shivo case and war in Iraq, the death penalty, abortion, Darfur? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joined tonight from New York by Richard John Newhouse, editor-in-chief of First Things, and from Dallas, Texas by William Lawrence, dean of the Perkins School of Theology at Southern Methodist University. Right now from Madison, Wisconsin by Patrick. Hi, Patrick. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Just to answer your question, I think there is a consistent life ethic, and it's simply this. It's very simple. You can't kill innocent people. Okay? It's that simple. Why are those people on the sidewalk down there in Florida praying? Because there is an innocent human being being starved to death who was not otherwise dying.
Patrick, let me just ask you, are they as passionate about deaths occurring from poverty in Africa, from AIDS, from war in Iraq, in Darfur? Perhaps you think they are, but if they're not, what justifies the difference?
Well, I would say you're muddying the waters.
Those are life and death issues, many innocent lives in all those circumstances.
Yeah, when there is an intentional killing, deliberate killing of an innocent human being, and when the entire country is involved in the conversation, and we come down on the wrong end of the question, it is downright frightening.
The whole world can see poverty, can see AIDS, can see war. These are not exactly invisible.
Those are all terrible things, but again, you're muddying the waters.
Why is it muddied? They involve the death of innocents.
Okay, but who is killing them? Who is intentionally, deliberately killing them? Is there a judge, an authority figure, saying, we are going to intentionally kill these innocent people?
Yep.
Is that what's happening there?
We hear it. So you see it highlighted with Terry Schiavo, and you say, this must not happen.
Yeah. Any civilized society must be based on some fundamental principles, and the most fundamental principle is you can't kill innocent people, whether it's abortion, what you're calling an end-of-life issue is not an end-of-life issue. Terry Schiavo is not dying.
What?
She is a handicapped woman. And who gets to decide? Mr. Lawrence is asking who gets to decide. Nobody gets to decide.
Well, what if she had decided? What if she did have a living will that was very specific, Patrick? Would you accept it?
I would say it would be immoral. Even Terry Schiavo could not say, you can withdraw my food, my nutrition and hydration to kill me. She cannot do that. You and I cannot commit suicide on a moral level.
Patrick, we've got it. Thank you very much for your call. William Lawrence, is this an authority issue? Is there moral teaching handed down by religion or moral philosophy that says, this is way out in the humanist weeds, you don't have the right, modern American, to make this choice, even if you foresaw the precise circumstance and said, I don't want to live in that way?
There certainly are bodies of teaching that could be cited to support the point of view that Patrick has just expressed, but there are equally strong bodies of teaching that can be cited within religious traditions in the Christian faith and in other faiths that would profoundly disagree with the position that Patrick has just articulated. So it is a matter of authority, but I will go back and say Patrick has himself expressed the freedom to make a choice and to articulate a certain moral point of view. He has every right to do that. My view is he does not have the right to impose his point of view on the Schiavo family in their dilemma.
Lisa's calling from Boston. Hi, Lisa, you're on the air.
I think actually the points that you've made have started to address the question and why I disagree with or am confused by what Patrick is saying, in that our government makes a choice, which I find abhorrent all the time, of withholding food to people in other nations, and they're called political sanctions. You know, they're political sanctions and embargoes and these kind of things. And, you know, I get confused that people can get stirred up about one thing, but then when it's on a massive level, and it is literally withholding food, I don't hear, anyone spending much time either covering or talking about the moral inconsistency of that, or speaking out with horror or falling to their knees praying about that. And I'm wondering if your speakers can comment, and I'll get off the phone so I can listen.
Thanks, Lisa. Richard John Newhouse, what about the issue of moral inconsistency, as Lisa puts it? Here's the Culture of Life banner. How much hypocrisy do you see riding under that?
I don't think there's hypocrisy there. I think Patrick...
I don't mean particularly in Patrick's case, but more broadly.
Patrick is exactly right, and I'd have to... take issue, I'm afraid, with Dr. Lawrence in this at all. There is no basis in the Christian tradition whatsoever from the very beginnings to approve of the principle that it is ever morally permissible to take an innocent human life. Christianity, from its beginnings, one of the things that most struck the pagan world was that Christians were adamantly opposed to practices such as abortion, infanticide, and suicide, which were very, very common and very commonly approved in the pagan world. So the Christian tradition is unanimous on that principle, that it is always wrong to intentionally take an innocent human life. Now, the application of that principle is something else. Mm. And it's not a specifically or uniquely Christian principle, one would underscore. What would it be in our society if the protections that we call human rights or civil rights were subject simply to the choice of other people, in which we'd say that if parents want to, for example, commit infanticide with a child that's 1 year old or 2 years old, that that's their choice. Surely we would find that totally abhorrent. It is a remarkable thing. You alluded earlier to the Vatican paper talking about our society and critical of American society in light of what's happening in the Schiavo case. Here I would disagree with the Vatican paper, if you will. I think it is a remarkably heartening thing that we are not the Netherlands. We are not the Netherlands where this kind of discussion does not take place and where we know by the admission of the people who do it that at least 1,000 adults are killed each year who do not request death. In other words, we move
in hospitals or hospices, you're saying,
to murder.
But let me ask you, though, about our caller Lisa's point on moral consistency. I think that the people who look at the fervor over the culture of life when it's applied to a case like Terry Schiavo's, the smiling, beaming face of a woman that the court says is in a persistent vegetative state, that all the fervor focused there, and then people look around and see starvation. They see death from AIDS and say, what's wrong with this picture?
You will find the people who are most intensively engaged in protecting the innocent unborn, in protecting people at the entrance gates and the exit gates of life, and the radically handicapped all along the way, that they are consistent in the principle that it is always wrong to take an innocent human life and it is always an imperative duty to try to do your best. Nobody, we know today, one-third of the people in Zimbabwe and Africa have AIDS. We know today that the life expectancy in Zimbabwe has dropped from 63 to 34 years old.
But are these same protesters on their knees in front of the White House asking for intervention there?
What would you suggest is being done? See, it's not a decision that is before you. You don't have a decision, nor do I, nor does any of your callers tonight, I assume, have a decision of what ought to be U.S. policy with regard to development, aid, hunger, and so forth.
Well, we can certainly have an opinion
express
it.
I, among many, many others, I write and agitate and speak all the time about what's happening, especially in Africa, which is so lamentably the forgotten continent. And so there is a perfect consistency here. The fact is that this is smoke and mirrors. We're getting away from the reality of a question posed to us. Should a radically handicapped person who has a name, Terry Schiavo, be killed because somebody thinks that her life is not worth living?
Well, we're not ignoring it, but we're looking at the context around it as well. We've just got a couple more minutes.
No, that's not the context. I'm sorry, AIDS in Zimbabwe is not the context. What's happening in that hospice in Florida right now? What's happening in that hospice in Florida right now is the question before us and before the nation, and it is an extraordinarily encouraging thing that millions upon millions of Americans are engaged in this discussion, because we are capable of politics understood as the determination of how we ought to order our life together, which is inescapably a moral question.
Father Newhouse, let me get one more call here. Bruce is calling from Durham, North Carolina. Bruce, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I guess I had a comment. I'm a physician, and I certainly see patients who have been in this sort of situation, and there was a comment that there are people that get to that situation and change their mind and want everything done. There's certainly those people that get to that point in their life and go through a code and afterwards never want to have that done to them again. And
go through a code?
To resuscitate.
I see, yes.
You know, cracking ribs.
And they're saying, let me go next time.
Driving needles into people's veins, and they wake up on a ventilator, and maybe they never get off. But I guess my comment was that we're talking about a culture of life versus a culture of death. I think that is a real straw man, a real mistreatment.
But the culture of life phrasing suggests it, whether or not we put it that way.
A culture of life versus a culture of choice. I mean, a culture of death is, you know, you're talking about nihilists and anarchists.
Right. As a doctor, you're saying permit the culture of choice.
Yes, that it's one thing to have somebody, you know, I don't think anybody in any of the scenarios we're talking about on either side of the Schiavo case are so much interested in killing people. But the question, not so much AIDS or, you know, other places, but the question here is for Terry Schiavo, if she said that it was her wish that she did not want to live in a persistently, you know, that she'll never get back to where she was, then do we have the right in this country to be able to make that decision?
Bruce,
or
our time
are
is short.
Are people going to make the decision for you, me, and everybody else?
I hear William Lawrence, Richard John Newhouse saying that he's adamantly, the Christianity itself, adamantly opposed to abortion, infanticide, suicide, and Terry Schiavo's case comes right under that adamant opposition. But you're holding open a door of choice here. Is it consistent with the religion?
Sure, because the whole matter of what it means to live out the Christian life and faith is a matter of making very difficult and painful choices. Some of those choices actually cost us something in order to make those decisions. We make choices all the time in the way we exercise our political viewpoints. One of the curious complications regarding the Schiavo case, for example, is that I understand the costs of her care are being borne by a combination of the settlement of a medical malpractice decision in a court and the funds that come from Medicaid programs. Meanwhile, our representatives in the nation's capital, in Congress, Senate, and House, are making decisions about cutting Medicaid and are making decisions about limiting the amount that can be reached as a settlement in a medical malpractice case. So we as voters make choices when we send the people who are our representatives and do so by urging them to reach a certain choice or a certain decision on the allocation of resources through national programs like Medicaid. These are choices that all of us make, and any attempt, in my view, to write what I would consider an oversimplified statement that attempts to be all-encompassing of all the complexities fails to realize these ground-level choices that are being made all the time by all of us and by those whom we choose as our representatives.
But Father Newhouse says that let's not muddy or complicate the issue of Terri Schiavo. There she is. She can be fed or not fed. And don't try and draw this banner of the culture of life, you know, too easily over all these other big issues of war and starvation. Let's say let's look at the instance right in front of us. Is it fair to draw that banner around this case alone? Bring the Bible up alongside and say there's only one answer here.
Well, look, it's not a question of saying there's only one answer here.
I heard you saying that you have to vote for life in the Christian tradition here.
It's a question that there's a moral principle.
Mm-hmm.
The application of a moral principle often gets very complex indeed. But right before us, we have, on the one hand, the moral principle, it is always wrong to deliberately take an innocent human life. And we got one person, we got a case in point that has generated this discussion. That's why we're on this in this discussion right here and now. And it is particularly troubling when Dr. Lawrence, for example, starts talking about the costs and the rationing of costs. The food and water that needs to be supplied to Miss Schiavo, it costs practically nothing.
Though her care over the years, you would acknowledge, has been expensive.
Who are eager to care for her, and financial offers of unlimited support. So there's you cannot put a dollar sign on a human life. There are times in which, when a person is in a position where that person is dying, and whatever help is being provided in terms of respirator or other high technology really is counterproductive. It's simply prolonging that person's death. And that's a circumstance in which thousands and thousands, if not millions of families have had personal experience. That is not the Terri Schiavo case.
But is it inconsistent for an administration to look to cut back on the kind of malpractice claims and Medicaid that have supported Terri Schiavo's considerable expenses over time, on the one hand? On the other hand, you know, wave the culture of life banner.
Tom, I love you, but please,
Oh, is it not a legitimate question?
We keep getting away from the question that is immediately before us.
But isn't that the point? Isn't there a whole fabric here? Isn't there a whole fabric here, though?
Well, yes. How we respond to this question will have a bearing on how we respond to other questions. And ultimately, the culture of life versus culture of death imagery is, I think, yes, despite your one caller who said it's polarizing, well, I'm sorry. There are conflicts in life in which decisions must be made. You know, in Deuteronomy, the Lord says, I've set before you life and death, choose life. Now, you can also arrive at that by sheer human reason and natural law. You don't need any divine revelation on it. What happens to our society? What kind of society do we become if we, in this case, which is critically important, make a decision, however, whether through the courts, whether through the legislature, some combination, the executive, etc., we make a decision in principle that lives that are radically handicapped are no longer worth supporting, and that the people who find those lives burdensome have a license to take those lives.
There's the issue. What happens is exactly the question. With that, we're out of time, I'm afraid. Richard John Newhouse, editor-in-chief of First Things, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
And William Lawrence, dean of the Theology School at Southern Methodist University, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome, sir.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.